This morning I'm in Chippenham with the Reverend Rod Key, who's just returned from his holidays. So
no, sadly, returned from a weekend away, but holidays still to come, which is very nice.
That's exciting. Yeah. But so you have been away. So yeah.
Nice to see you.
The first question, Rod, is when and where did we first meet?
We first met when I was being interviewed for the post of parish priest at St Andrew's Chippenham, which was a rather fraught and stressful time for me, but it was very nice to meet you. You were part of the group of clergy who came to sort of represent the deanery and welcomed the possible candidates, three candidates, and at that time I thought I'd totally fluffed it, so I was kind of given up on all hope of being offered the job, so I probably was a bit more relaxed by that stage. But that's when we met, and I thought you were Scottish. I don't know why. Named Janet, and I said, yeah, it must be Scottish, but you're not.
And the rest of it. No, I am an eighth Swedish, though.
Oh, well,
that's the Anderson.
Aha, yes. Well, it would, wouldn't it?
My cousin has traced it back to the Anders when they actually settled the names in Sweden.
Yeah.
Back to them. So she's got all that bit, but there's quite a lot of Northern Scottish and other bits in my past. Yeah. So do you drink tea?
I was an avid tea drinker until health issues made it more difficult. I was advised to stop drinking tea in order to control what comes out the other end, and now I have to sadly forego tea.
So what was your favourite cup of tea?
Basic builder's tea. Needs to be stewed for long enough, but not stirred, and definitely not squeeze the tea bag. And as long as done like that, and a little dash of milk, no sugar, perfect for a hot day. Can't, but sad, distant memory in the past now for me.
So, what was the, if you had one cup of tea that was the best cup of tea in your past, do you know which it would be?
I think it was a cup of tea that we had at a sort of posh tea at a restaurant in Norfolk where we were before we came here. And it was a restaurant that did afternoon tea in a big way. And when they brought the tea out, it tasted, I can't put my finger on what tasted different, but it was a very interesting blend. But I've never been able to replicate it. They said it had some Lapsang Souchong in as well as Assam tea, but that was a memorable cup of tea. That was with a very nice sandwich and cream tea as well. So.
We've got a voucher for a cream tea, which we haven't been to yet because I know we need to get all the family together, but also I need to phone them up and go, I can't have anything gluten.
Gluten-free scones, please.
Oh, gluten-free scones are very crumbly.
I imagine.
Normally. I had a very nice
gluten
one.
Gluten being the bit that glues it together.
I had a very nice one in Sudsbury in Suffolk. And I knew it was gluten-free because as I picked it up, it broke into pieces. <Four days. laughs> So I then did the sort of jam and cream and ate it with a spoon. I find that has to be the way.
You can have one in Chipping Sudbury, which is near, a little bit nearer to home. Maybe they would.
Maybe they might. So the question which I'm asking everybody is, how do you respond to the statement, Christianity in the UK is not dying, but sleeping?
Christianity is not dying or sleeping, is my response. Christianity is a vibrant living thing that can't be. It's the people who represent Christianity, I think, who are sleepwalking, shall we say, not waking up to the fact that major change is necessary. So I wouldn't say that Christianity itself was ever sleeping. It's always on the way towards the next thing, which is a travelling sort of thing rather than a sleepy sort of thing.
So what examples of sleepwalking from kind of more institutional church would you think about? What do you think will need to change?
Well, we've somehow in the last 30 or 40 years taken on the mantle of carers of buildings, which we never really wanted, probably 50 years, but which I think we've got to say, These are very beautiful buildings, and if the nation wants to keep them, here they are. They are something that we cannot carry the burden of, and we should not be spending our time trying to do so. They're very useful and we're very pleased to use them, but we have somehow shouldered the total responsibility for maintaining them, and I just think that is that is not only unsustainable, but that is taking us towards the sort of death of the Church of England, not of Christianity, but of the established church.
I have
seven.
No, we've got five worship centres, four of which are Grade 1 star listed in three parishes. And it is a huge amount of time, the burden of the buildings and of everybody's energy.
It's a question of ownership, really, of the nation saying, you know, they'd be very quickly up in arms if we were to, say, hand the keys in at the town hall. So we've done with these. But they do expect them to be maintained and kept open and celebrated, and we as a community have not found a way of being responsible for them to take over from the old sort of medieval system where the manor house paid for the church and provided it and maintained it and paid for a priest, and that system. All that has fallen apart, but it just can't be done.
What I don't really understand is part of that kind of transition is where that kind of stopped being the expectation on the rich that they would keep the church in good order. I don't know when that sort of changed.
Well, yeah, I suppose the first urban churches were kind of mission churches. They were not, you know, they had no attachment to a sort of feudal system in the way that the rural churches did. So they became dependent on grants and giving from the more established churches and in a mission situation. And then when they became parish churches, they had to start sustaining themselves. But most of those buildings were more manageable because they were relatively modern. They were Victorian plus buildings rather than medieval buildings. But then that sort of grew when the people who owned the manor houses no longer wanted to go to church or take responsibility. They found that they had no legal requirement to do so, I suppose. And they just said, oh, okay, not our problem.
I'm not sure that we're very good at asking the very rich for the sort of sums of money that used to be given.
Yeah.
But I'm not quite sure how we might do that. I think there are still some places where there are churches which are maintained mainly by the generosity of the richest of the...
Yeah, it comes with strings attached now. That's the trouble, isn't it? Because the landowner then says, well, I'll pay for your rethatching of your little nice church roof, but only if you provide me with a prayer book service for Christmas and all that. You know, things done the way I want them all. You know. So, yeah, the trouble is that if you look for outside money, you become dependent on it, and it needs to just be, the government needs to recognise that these buildings are a community asset, not a religious asset.
So you were a vicar in Norfolk. How many churches did you have there, church buildings?
Yeah, ten churches to start with, and then we managed to close some of them and bring it down to five after 10 years.
And what were the real challenges of closing those church buildings?
The challenge is that that you can't actually close them anymore unless they are taken over by the redundant churches commission, and they say they have no more money to sustain any other empty buildings. They've reached the limit of what they can do. So you can mothball it. You can say, we will no longer be using this church for services. It will be, you know, insured. It will be kept watertight, but we will not be investing anything in it. That's the best you can do, really. So we still had all those 10 buildings, but only 5 that were parish churches and in use. And it helped, but it's not you know, a real solution.
So what size populations were those churches supposed to be for, the ones which you closed?
Well, varied, yeah. Nothing more than 200 in the parish of each of those, some of them 80 people, sort of less than 50 houses in the entire parish. And some of them, you know, we had a congregation of 8 in one church and not one of them lived within the parish boundaries. They all came from outside the parish, so nobody from that parish went to their parish church.
What were the joys of being in that rural situation, of having those groups of churches?
The joys were when people just caught the vision. If we would have a team service where all 10 churches came together and they filled the church, because on a Sunday in those 10 churches we had a total congregation of maybe 160, 170 people, and put those all into one church and give it your best shot, whether it's sort of Anglican Catholic sort of sung Eucharist or a family worship or a Taizé evening, with everybody there, it really, you really felt this, this has a potential for the future, this can survive, kind of thing. But mostly people then said, yeah, that's all very well, but next Sunday we'll go back to our church, kind of thing.
And I guess that ties into my other question about rural and urban spirituality. So now you're in Chippenham, kind of an urban town setting. What have been your reflections about the difference between spirituality of the town and of the villages?
Yes, certainly the village is much more focused on the building, and much more energy balance is about keeping going. It's a keeping going mentality of spirituality. It's not looking for what God is doing next kind of spirituality. Whereas in the town, there's much more a sense of, if this is different, we'll give it a try and see if it's going to work. And very much in the town, I think the building is loved and valued, but mostly for its usefulness. So if you wanted to have a sort of servery and toilets, let's do it. Let's change the building to make it suit what we need. Whereas in the villages, there's much that we certainly Norfolk villages, there was much more of a sense in which, it was, the church was good enough for my grandfather without a toilet, so it's good enough for me, kind of thing. I said, well, kitchen without a fridge was good enough for your granddad, but you're going to have your sort of slab of marble in your kitchen because you don't want to face any change. So I think the spirituality was not working, not alive to new possibilities in rural areas.
And the dean talked about the Church of England being in a bit of a panic, being quite anxious about if we don't get more support, then the Church of England will collapse. And it's difficult, especially in the current situation, because nobody wants to go to their village and say, if you don't start coming to church and supporting the church financially, we won't be here in 10 years' time. Is that the truth or is that scaremongering?
It's not the good news of the gospel. That's the trouble. It's not a reason for coming to church. Please come to church, because if you don't, we've got to have a more joyful message than that. And people don't want it. And it's not our fault that they don't want it, that the world has changed. And so are we not packaging it right? Are we not presenting it right? No. We're as faithful as they were 100 years ago. We're as good clergy as they were 100 years ago when the places were packed. It's the culture that's changed. So I don't think there's anything that we can do. I don't think better mission, better outreach, going for growth, none of these things are going to make any difference, because that isn't the reason, that's not the reason people are not coming to church. They don't come to church, they don't feel no need for any spiritual sustenance at all. The secular world provides them, they think, with all they need. They're not happy, but they think happiness lies in getting more stuff. And the less happy they are, the more stuff they want to make them happy. That's the basic approach. And we've got to be a church that survives that and waits until a culture says, you know, this has been a real bugger. This, you know, we don't want this anymore. You know, there's more to life than just stuff. You know, and but they, at the moment they don't. They think, you know, if I get the new iPhone, if I get the new widescreen TV, I'll be happy.
I think there is a turn. The retail sales index has fallen month after month after month for many months.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Do they say, why are people not shopping? Why are they not shopping? Perhaps they've got enough stuff.
I think there are some people who are beginning to say there's too much stuff.
Yeah.
And I think the whole anti-plastic thing is part of that as well. And I think it's a challenge for us all.
Yeah. We get back to the sort of Celtic monastic model of saying, you know, we need to provide solid, sustainable points of worship, worshipping communities that have something to offer to those who are disillusioned with the secular world. And we can't do that if we're spread too thinly. So you could, out of my 10 churches in Norfolk, there were three viable ones, really. And if the other seven closed and everybody was piled into, you would then have three strong, vibrant, welcoming, inclusive places of worship that can, you know, could weather the storm. And that's all we can do, really, is to say, this is what we have to offer. We can't package it in a different way. We can't sell it to you. We can't make you come to church because the building's going to fall down. You know, all we can do is stay here and wait until the things that we believe matter start to matter to the world again. And they do. You know, in the rest of the world, they do. In the developing world, huge. You know, people, faith is a huge thing. It's only here that it's not. And, you know, we're just out of line with the rest of history, really. We're just a sort of blip. But we happen to be, you know, ministering and trying to be faithful in that situation. And I think it will pass, but we need the church to still be there when it does pass. And to do that, have that model, and have that way of looking at it, you say the absolute priority is strong, joyful, settled, reliable places of worship. And, you know, if we've not got enough priests, then there must be fewer places of worship, because strong places of worship are useful. You know, doing 8 o'clock communion for 7.5 people on a Sunday is not gospel stuff, not kingdom stuff. So, you know, that's why, anyway, but I failed. I left 10 years in Norfolk. I tried everything, and I came away thinking I failed. And it's nice to be at St Andrews, where what I do seems to be needed. So it's, you know, it's been a complete new refreshment to me, a new lease of life. Before I was, so, you know, take my hat off to you for sticking at it. But rural ministry almost crushed me.
I think some people would argue what I do isn't rural ministry, because it's commuter rural.
Yeah, that does make
a
difference.
And we've got two big villages.
Yeah.
So it's not the same as what you were doing.
Yeah, if you've got a group that's, you know, it's hardly got a pub or a school in between 12 parishes, then it's even worse.
So the last question is, what is your favourite thing that begins with T?
Oh, that's easy. Tolkien.
Ooh.
Unless you say that begins with a J, R-R.
No, we've accepted Tolkien. Have you? Before.
No, I'm not the first one to.
No.
Yeah. Do you want me to say why?
Yes, I do want you to say why.
Because he is the most influential Christian writer of the 20th century. Because he tells stories, and at the depth of those stories are the most subtle and mysterious and deep the moving Christian themes, and he gets it across that this is what life is about, this, without preaching. And storytelling is the way to do that. And you start to recognise nobility and sacrifice and goodness holding on to the very last in the face of insurmountable odds, and the things that really and I think it's got everything from the 20th century in it. In The Lord of the Rings, it's everything from the First World War through to the sort of modern mechanical age and the problems that it was going to bring. He was a great visionary, and it's presented in a subtle, imaginative and digestible way. And I think nobody who's read the whole of The Lord of the Rings would be unaffected by it.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for having me here today, Rod.
You're very welcome. I hope the tea was up to standard.
Tea was lovely.